Heute zu Gast der internationale Mega-Bestseller-Autor und Star-Coach Robin Sharma.
I've mentored for 15 plus years professional athletes, billionaires, sports superstars, entertainment royalty. And I can personally tell you there are a lot of these people, Chris, they are cash rich and they're life poor.
When was the first time that you realized that excellence is your preferred operational mode?
Our society has programmed us into this idea that you are rich when you have a lot of money. You are rich when you have a big stock portfolio. You are rich when you have many homes. We need money. But there are seven other forms of wealth that if we don't nurture them and live them, I don't think it's possible to live a rich life. All it takes is to become iconic and legendary. When you go to the jagged edges of your potential and push your magic into the world, I think it's so good for your soul. It's who you become on the process of getting the work done. Is worth more than all the money in the world.
If you look back on your personal ups and downs in life, what is your most important lesson? Hey, Chris Sorell hier und das ist dein Podcast über das Auf und Ab des Lebens. Robin Sharma ist weltweit einer der berühmtesten Leadership- und Personal Development-Experten. Man kann sagen, er ist eine lebende Legende. Weltweit haben mehr als 25 Millionen Menschen seine Bücher gelesen und diese wurden in 92 Sprachen übersetzt. Er ist der Erfinder des sehr berühmten 5am Clubs und er ist einer der meistgelesenen lebenden Autoren auf der Welt. Ihm folgen auf Social Media 7 Millionen Menschen. Ich bin einer davon, bin ein großer Fan von ihm und er coacht die erfolgreichsten Menschen auf der Welt, darunter Tech-Milliardäre, Spitzensportler, Popstars und Unternehmen wie Nike und auch die NASA. Deshalb freut es mich ganz besonders, dass er meiner Einladung in den Auf und Ab Podcast gefolgt ist, denn wir haben ein sehr, sehr inspirierendes Gespräch geführt. Es war wirklich eine Wonne, ihm beim Reden zuzuhören und zuzusehen. Wir sprechen darüber, warum Exzellenz in seinem Leben so eine herausragend wichtige Rolle spielt, wie seine persönlichen Krisen ihn zu dem Menschen gemacht haben, der er heute ist. Wir sprechen über Reichtum, aber nicht nur über Geld, sondern vor allem über 7 weitere Arten des Reichtums, die man mit Geld nicht kaufen kann. Er teilt sehr viele Weisheiten. Wer ihn kennt, weiß, dass er fast wie ein wandelndes Zitate-Lexikon ist. Er gibt sehr konkrete, umsetzbare Tipps, Tricks, Weisheiten und Strategien. Und wir sprechen über sein neues Buch Wealth Money Can Buy, was auch in der deutschen Übersetzung gibt. Es ist schon in über 30 Ländern auf den Bestsellerlisten, in vielen Ländern davon auf Nummer 1. Und ich persönlich habe mich schon während des Gesprächs, aber auch lange danach noch richtig beseelt gefühlt. Und ich bin mir ziemlich sicher, dass es euch genauso gehen wird. Bevor wir einsteigen, ganz kurz, 70% der Menschen, die diesen Podcast hören und regelmäßig hören, haben ihn noch nicht abonniert. Und deshalb möchte ich euch um einen Gefallen bitten. Wenn euch dieser Podcast gefällt, wenn ihr ihn regelmäßig hört, dann bitte drückt auf diesen Abonnieren, auf diesen Folgen-Button, auf Spotify, auf Apple und gebt uns eine Bewertung. Denn je mehr Menschen diesem Podcast folgen und je mehr 5-Sterne-Bewertungen wir haben, desto spannendere Gäste kann ich vor dieses Mikrofon bringen und desto besser können wir diese Show machen. Für dich sind es nur ein paar Klicks, aber für das Auf- und Ab-Format ein Riesenschritt nach vorne. Vielen, vielen Dank für eure Unterstützung und jetzt würde ich vorschlagen, wir steigen direkt ein in das Auf und Ab von Robin Sharma. Robin, I just told you when we met that it's such a big honor to meet you in person. I'm a huge fan of your work since years and years, and now sitting next to you in front of you is really great blessing. So thanks for having for being here.
Chris, it's an absolute pleasure to see you.
That's good. When people who know you, they would say, I'm right if I say that with every word you speak or write, we can sense your passion for excellence. And my first question for you, Robin, is when was the first time that you realized that excellence is your preferred operational mode and not average or even mediocrity?
Wow, what an amazing question. You know, when I was growing up, many people didn't see a lot in me. Okay. And I had a great grade five teacher. Her name was Cora Greenaway. And she was one of the first people to believe in me. And she was my history teacher in grade five. But she taught me so much about excellence and dreaming big, as simple as that sounds, and reaching for something higher. So she planted a lot of seeds for sure. When I was a litigation lawyer, I was very blessed to clerk for a chief justice. And he was a man of excellence, very humble, you know, a very simple car. Here's a titan of justice, and he had a very simple car, but his approach to everything that he did, Chris, was excellent. So he had a big influence on me. In my 20s, I had a neighbor. Everyone else at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, they were at work, and I would walk by his beautiful house, and he would be in the backyard sunbathing in his shorts. He was a bond trader. We became great friends, and he really planted some seeds of excellence. So I would say in my late teens and early 20s, I started developing this fascination with the great artists and the great athletes and the great women and men of the world.
Okay, interesting. And now you deliver excellent pieces of art almost every year. One of them is your new book that we'll dive deep into the next minutes. One deep dive question on excellence, because this is something that I personally sometimes struggle and many people struggle, which is this. There is a trade-off between delivering excellence on a continuous basis and having speed and time to market. Many people these days promote the concept of 80-20, which means with 20% of effort, you reach an 80% okay-ish goal. They say this is better. And I'm really curious what you think about these kinds of concepts that say 80% is enough if you're fast as a result.
I don't think Michelangelo was worried about speed. I don't think Basquiat was thinking about speed. I don't think J.D. Salinger, when he was writing the masterpiece Catcher in the Rye, was worried about speed. So I think it's much wiser to push one masterwork into the marketplace than 1,000 mediocrities. I think you're right. We live in a world of speed, and we live in a world, I think, where there's a lot of people. They think that if they're not pushing out content and hustling, grinding, they're being left behind. I would suggest all it takes is one Taj Mahal to make your mark on the world. All it takes is one Moonlight Sonata to become iconic and legendary. So what I try to do, yes, in the past few years, I've done the 5 a.m. Club, the Everyday Hero Manifesto, the new book, The Wealth Money Can't Buy. Intuitively, this is what feels right to me. Mm-hmm. I might not write another book for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I might not write another book for 10 years. I'm trying to trust my creative integrity more than here's what the market wants and here's what I must do to please people.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And all those examples that you gave, it's an interesting concept in your book, which you call your personal project X. And we'll talk about this in a few minutes. I love it. And this has nothing to do with X, the social media platform. Now, let's dive a little deeper into your book. You've already mentioned the title, The Wealth Money Can't Buy, and the subtitle is The 8 Hidden Habits to Live Your Richest Life. To be honest, Robin, it took me longer than normal to read this, and I explain you why. Because I'm not a native English speaker, and I reread almost every sentence, because those sentences are a piece of art in itself. What kind of vocabulary you use, how you crafted the sentences, it's really just not even talking about the content, but the style you write it as such. You again see that you strive for excellence, and this is what you've achieved in this book again. So congratulations on this one.
Thank you.
For those listeners who are deep into this whole personal development topic and even have read some or even all of your previous books, why should they care about this one? So what can they expect from it?
Well, first of all, again, thank you for such generous comments. It means a lot to me. I spent 1 year of my life last year writing the book. And I call it a beautiful suffering. I wrote It took me 20 versions of the manuscript, probably 10,000 changes per manuscript to make it simple.
Wow.
And it was a beautiful suffering because it was hard work. I wanted it to be the best book I've ever done. But it was beautiful because when you go to the jagged edges of your potential and push your magic into the world, I think it's so good for your soul. I think it's so good for, even if no one reads the book, you know, just having done it, I think it's key for me as an artist. And one of my friends said, she said, you didn't just write your book, the book wrote you. And I think that speaks to all of us doing our best work. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not only the trophy of finishing the work, it's who you become on the process of getting the work done. So why did I write this book, or what do I hope it'll do for people? Our society has programmed us into this idea that you are rich when you have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You are rich when you have a big stock portfolio. You are rich when you have many homes. We pedestal the billionaire, but we forget there are other forms of wealth. I've mentored for 15 plus years professional athletes, billionaires, sports superstars, entertainment royalty. And I can personally tell you there are a lot of these people, Chris, they are cash rich and they're life poor. Mm-hmm. So money, or I'd put it to you this way, integrity is worth more than all the money in the world. A happy home life, you can't put a price tag on it. Good health is worth more than cash in the bank. I'm not saying money is not important. The fifth form of wealth, and the wealth money can't buy, is prosperity, financial wealth. Mm-hmm. We need money to put food on the family table. We need money to take care of our responsibilities. We need money to help those in need often. So there's 25 chapters in how the billionaires think, what their habits are, how they did it. But there are seven other forms of wealth that if we don't nurture them and live them, I don't think it's possible to live a rich life.
Yeah. And I want to dive into some of those alternative forms of wealth in the next minutes. It's interesting that you say those who achieve these great sums of euros, dollars, yens, or whatever, they realize this. But the funny or tragic thing is that those who will never realize it still follow this dream that their life would change if they had money. And there's one quote from the Hollywood superstar Jim Carrey. I'm sure you know him. He said, and I read this, I think everybody should get rich and famous so they can see that it's not the answer. And I think it's beautiful to imagine that for one or two days, everybody on this planet would be rich, and then everyone would see that it's not the answer. And you provide here some alternative definitions of wealth, and that's what we're going to dive into. Pretty much in the beginning of this wonderful book, Robin, you talk about celebrating our scars and worshiping our wounds. And in a side note, you say, okay, I know what I'm talking about because I've been there too. So my question to you is, what was in your life your most painful event or setback that provided you with the most valuable lesson?
You know, I've gone through some relationship problems in the past. Those were very difficult in the moment. There's a great expression, a bad day for the ego is a great day for the soul. Mm-hmm. So when I went through it, absolutely miserable. Rumi said it really well. He said, keep breaking your heart over and over until it opens. So if you look at the great humans, I'm not saying I'm a great human, but if you look at the great ones, they all had one thing in common. They suffered the most. So, and I know this is a huge theme of your podcast, Chris, but suffering, when we are in it, we want to be out of it. But when we are in it, that's when we get our gold. And it's so counterintuitive, but I would actually say that suffering is part of the wealth money can't buy. Because it's suffering and through adversity and troubles that we are introduced to our strength. It's through adversity that we are introduced to wisdom. It's through hard times that we wake up to what's most important in our life. I mean, a lot of people have to go through a divorce to realize that family is wealth money can't buy.
So did I.
You went through, really? Hmm. And what would, were there benefits in that difficult time?
Exactly like you said. So when you're in it, you want to get out of it. I love it. I will brain tattoo it into my my head. But what I realized, and this is very personal, I learned what kind of values are in my heart, and looking for those values in other people, because many relationships, they weren't a value fit. And now I'm in my second and last marriage, and Janina and me, we have a wonderful overlap of key values in life. So I would sign for sure that this was of huge benefit for me.
No, it's interesting. So we've had the same experience with adversity, and it's counterintuitive advice, but most of us, when we're in a difficult time, whether it's business, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a spiritual struggle, whether it's a financial struggle, whether someone's betrayed us, we want to get out and back to the sunshine. And I would actually suggest stay in it as long as possible, because pain is a purifier. Pain is a purifier. And I remember being on an airplane sitting next to an artist on the way to Paris, and he said, I always pick relationship partners that break my heart. And I said, why? He said, that's when I do my best art.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at
I have a question on this? Because
yes.
You say stay in it as long as you can. I think listeners should not mix it up with not trying to change the situation or not learning from it. So it's not a masochistic way of thinking, I enjoy this, but... Or you can clarify on this, but this was what I was thinking. I think we can try to get away from it by elaborating our skills and our craft. Or do I get this wrong?
No, I think you're right. Yes, KMF, keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
Do your part to bring your ideal life back. Yet, at the same time, embrace the beauty of suffering. Embrace the gifts of the difficulty. Mm-hmm. Because if you rush out too quickly, you're going to miss all the learning.
Yes.
When do we journal? I remember one difficult season of my life. I remember in 1 month, I journaled 600 pages.
Wow.
I was confused and I was hurting and I wanted answers, but I was learning so much as well. And so I think... by staying in there, we absolutely learn so much. There's a chapter in the book in the third form of wealth, which is family.
Mm-hmm.
And the chapter's called Your Hurters Are Your Helpers. And isn't it true? Or I'm curious if you agree, but it's the people who hurt us the most that at some level teach us the best.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you just said you wrote 600 pages of journaling, this is, for you it's normal, but this is super inspiring, because an alternative strategy could be that you put 10 bottles of beer into your body at this time, go partying, dancing or whatever, and run away from those problems. But if you really dive deep into your emotions and try to heal these traumatic experiences, then it leads to your next level.
I think what we often forget is we will never rise any higher in the world than who we are. Sometimes people dismiss personal development. They say, no, I need to focus on building a great team. I need to focus on refining my products and services. I need to build a great culture. I need to do external things to get to my personal Mount Everest. Yet what could be wiser and actually more efficient than building a strong interior core? The Spartan warriors said it so well, sweat more in training and you'll bleed less in war. Mm-hmm. Your incoming, your impact always reflect your self-identity. So by working on our mindset and what I call heart set, our emotional life and our health set, our physical life and our soul set, our spiritual life, these four interior empires, then every work project we touch reflects that power. Every relationship we have reflects that strength inside. Everything we do reflects that magic and intimacy with our genius that we've worked on within ourselves. So as within, so without. And of course, we want to build beautiful lives and healthy lives and fun lives. And so much of the book is about those things. But let's not forget that I don't think the goal of life is to be successful. I think in many ways, the goal of life is to become the highest version of your greatest vision for yourself. I think the real winning is growth, not the beautiful external life that is the reflection of that growth.
Mm, couldn't agree more. Now, behind those sources of wealth are hidden habits, like you call them. And there's probably not many people on this planet who are better in teaching people how to get better habits. But the reality is also that most people are not really good in installing new habits. Just take a look when we have New Year, millions of people, they have New Year's resolutions. And by the end of February, they are back to their old life. What is the mental price we pay, Robin, if we don't follow through our goals and our New Year's resolutions and the stuff that we want to do but fail? What's the mental price we pay?
Pain.
Yes.
The mental price is discouragement. The mental price is not liking ourselves very much. Potential unexpressed turns to pain. We are born with such possibility. We are born with eyes that sparkle. When we're little kids, we want to be astronauts. We want to be poets. We want to be athletes. We want to do amazing things. And then as we move through life, we receive this programming from the world. Be average. Don't dream too big. Don't shine too brightly. Fit in with the crowd. Don't think differently from everyone else. And also within ourselves, we take risks and we fail. And rather than using failure as fuel, we start to protect ourselves. And we almost set up a mental program, you ask intellectually, we almost set up a mental program, which is, oh, the world is not a safe place. So we live within a box and we spend so many of our best hours watching television in a subdivision. And so the mental price is we betray ourselves. The mental price is we lose self-respect. The mental price of not daring and not installing great habits and not living our best is we lose faith in ourselves. And I think that creates a huge amount of pain. And what we do is we start to medicate ourselves with too much phone time, too much worrying, too much gossiping, too much work, too much alcohol, because we know at a deep level we've betrayed our potential, so we can't face it, so we run from it.
Mm-hmm. This was a line, it was not in this book, but in your 5 a.m. club that sticks to my mind, and that says, if you don't follow through your habits, it's self-hatred. And this is something I experienced in other times of my life, and I see when I work with people, and there's probably nothing more frustrating if you say, I will do this, and you won't do it, because you lose respect for yourself, as you said. You feel weaker and weaker and weaker. And many people run around and have very low self-worth, and they think other people are born with it, but you give a step-by-step instruction how you can level up your self-worth and your self-esteem. And maybe you can share a bit of your ideas, how people who feel low regarding their self-worth can, with their own two hands and their own brain, really level it up.
What a powerful question, Chris. Lao Tzu said, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. Often we see the titans, we see the heroes, we see the icons, and we fall into the seduction of thinking they are cut from a different cloth. Genius is less about genetics, and genius is more about practice. There's one chapter in the book, the best way to start is to start.
Yeah.
People often say, so where do I start? You just start. You want to run a marathon? Get off the couch. Go for the first step. You want to write a book? Write the first paragraph. You want the love of your life? You mentioned Nina. You want the love of your life? Walk over to that person in the avocado section at your grocery store and start a conversation.
And it sounds so cliche, but basically it is how you say it. People overcomplicate the starting process. They make plans, Excel sheets or whatever. But this is one of my favorite chapters in the book. I have it. This would be my next question, but now you bring it up. And the best way to start is to start. Get away the complicated stuff, the rumination about it, and do the first step. There's a beautiful quote. I know you like quotes, and this one from Mark Twain, who said the secret to getting ahead is getting started. Everyone knows this line, but there's a second line which says, the secret of getting started is breaking down your complex, overwhelming tasks into smaller, manageable tasks, and then starting on the first one. And this helped me in my life extremely. Every time I was stuck in procrastination or whatever, the first step was too big. And this can be fearing, alarming, whatever. But if you manage to put it into a smaller micro step, then it becomes easy.
You know, I'm just making some notes so I can be responsive to what you're saying. So we're on the same page. There's a brain tattoo that I have in my methodology, and it's small, daily, seemingly insignificant improvements, when done consistently over time, lead to stunning results.
Wow.
It's not what consistency is the mother of mastery. It's not what you do once a year. It's what you do every day. Your days are your life in miniature. As you craft today, so you craft your life.
Can you repeat this one, please? The miniature, because I love it. And hearing it from your mouth is so powerful.
Your days are your life in miniature. As you live today, so you're creating your tomorrows. Your days become weeks. Your weeks become months. Your months become quarters. Your quarters become years. Your years become decades. Just take care of today and then do it consistently. So the exciting thing for you, me, and all of your many listeners is it's the little things that you do, what I call micro wins. For years, I've been calling them the 1% wins. But those, as you do them consistently over time, they compound into huge results. So your question was, well, how can we install the habits? And it does begin with our self-image. Our daily behavior reflects our deepest beliefs. Our income and our impact reflects our self-identity. So we can try to have good habits, but if our self-identity and our self-perception is of undeservability and I'm not the kind of person who could be great, then we will always be at war. We'll read the books, we'll listen to the pundits, but deep inside, often subconsciously, we will sabotage ourselves because we just don't think we're worthy of the great health and the love and the financial wealth and the career acclaim. So one way to increase our self-identity is, it sounds so simple, but keep your promises. When you make a promise to a friend to say, I'm going to meet you for lunch, follow through. When you say to your child, if you're a parent, I'm going to read to you tonight, follow through. When you say to your significant other or your work colleague, I'm going to sit down with you and we're going to do this, follow through. Be a human being who is absolutely careful about the promises. But here's the real key. Keep the promises you make to yourself. Mm-hmm. And the more you say, oh, I'm going to make the bed today, I'm going to polish my shoes, I'm going to join the 5 a.m. club, I'm going to fast. I'm not giving medical advice, but you're going to fast. Or tonight I will turn off the TV and I will read. Each time you follow through on a self-promise, you grow a little more in self-respect. And so world-class willpower and following through on habits and high self-respect comes from closing the loops on promises you make to yourself. And it starts off by little promise. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. But the more you make these micro wins, the more something deep inside you starts to shift, and you become more brave, and you stop being a victim and giving away your power to all these excuses, and you just start to grow. Bravery and inner strength is a practice. You want to get great at chess or cooking, you practice. You want to be great at getting beautiful things done, you practice it by following through on the little promises you make to yourself.
And this is so powerful because I see again and again that people, you said chess, everybody understands I need to practice chess a lot to become great. But hardly any people realize that becoming great in your head, becoming a strong thinker and having a strong mindset is also practice. People have excuses that their parents didn't raise them up in a supportive way or that genetics is not the right setting or whatever. But it is practice as every other skill that we have.
Well, the human being has a gift. Anyone who listening right now is saying, well, this doesn't apply to me. Let's go to the science. Every human being on the planet has a gift, and the gift is called neuroplasticity. And that is a brain designed to adapt and grow according to practice. So you're right. We all know I'm learning Italian right now. Mm-hmm. I have to practice Italian to get more fluent at it. But often when we see people doing heroic things, producing works of art, producing great businesses, producing great lives or great interior lives, great spiritual lives, we think these people are somehow different from us. But we miss out on the 30 years of anonymous where they were working silently on becoming and developing the skills that they are currently showing. So we all have a gift, but often we want the rewards of world class, but we're not willing to do what world class requires. It's the world we live in. It's a world I think we're, a lot of us, it's almost entitlement. Mm-hmm. We want these beautiful lives, but we're not willing to put in the sweat equity and practice and focus and dedication to get those results.
It's interesting. Just the other day, I watched Roger Federer, my hero in tennis. I was a tennis player in my first life. And he did a commencement speech at one university just a few days ago. And he said he was pretty frustrated that everybody was saying it looks so easy when he's playing tennis because nobody would realize that it took him years and decades to make it look easy. People think he's the most talented one, which might be true, but as we both know, is not enough by far in the elite sphere. And he said in the beginning he was quite frustrated, but he learned to see it as something of respect. But at first he said, guys, it's not easy just because it looks easy. You know what I mean? Or what he means?
I hear you and I do. And I think a lot of people say, you got lucky. You got lucky, Chris. You're so successful. Or they see a billionaire, or they see an athlete, or they see a human being who has integrity and a happy heart and beautiful relationships. And they say, oh, you got lucky. I think that reveals a few belief systems. I say this with a lot of respect, but I think it shows that they don't know what it takes to build world class or that kind of performance. Mm-hmm. I think also it's very easy to say someone you admire is lucky because then it almost removes you of the personal responsibility of having to invest the devotion and the study and the sacrifice and the consistency and the resilience and the dedication to do the thing you admire, if that makes sense to
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
It's much easier for me to say, well, he's lucky.
You have an external excuse, right?
It's removing self-responsibility versus saying, she did it, he did it, so I can do it. So, I mean, I think of Roger Bannister. The world said a human being could not do a sub-4-minute mile.
Yeah.
And then he did it. He literally shifted
human perception.
We often forget we see the world not as we are. We see not as it is. We see the world as we are. Mm-hmm. And our job, I think, each day is to create what I call micro bravery, to do little acts of daring, to pursue the areas we are uncomfortable in, to lean into our fears, even if it's the smallest little fear, because each time we do that, we recreate our version of reality. And we become possibilitarians. And so that's what Roger Bannister did. He did the impossible and recreated what was possible. And isn't it interesting, in the weeks and months that followed, people saw his lead and said, I can do that too. And they ran sub 4 minute miles. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important for us to remember if someone else is doing something, we too can do it. It's not magic. It's not lucky. There are a series of beliefs and behaviors and habits that create world-class or greatness or happy lives or inner peace. If we do those things, we'll get those results.
Absolutely. I want to switch gears to another concept that surprised me the most in this book. And this is where you say we need to become yes persons. And I tell you why it surprised me on a headline level. If you read into the chapter, I get the concept. But my first thinking was that we are told by quite successful people like Warren Buffett and many other billionaires or elite performers that we should become better at saying no. Warren Buffett says, say almost no to anything and focus and double down on the stuff that moves the needle forward. Now you say become a more yes person. And for those who will not read the chapter in detail, please explain how these two concepts that are both true, I would argue, how they fit together.
Well, it depends on the context. It's exactly what you say. I am very much someone who says, build your life around a few things. I am very much someone who suggests be a minimalist versus a maximalist. There's so much in the wealth money can't buy around being a minimalist, doing a few things extremely well, yeah, building your life around a few priorities, not being addicted to distraction because that's the end of creative production. Having said that, the chapter you're talking about, Be a Yes Person, comes from a meeting I had with the son of a very famous speaker. And I said, how's your father doing? And he said, oh, he's in his 80s. You'd know this speaker. And he said, his father's in his 80s. And I said, how's he doing? And he said, he says yes to everything. You want him to go speak here? He says, yes. There's an opportunity. He says, yes. He's like, he's just doing so well in his 80s. And that made me think about, in the context of saying yes to life, just be more open. I mean, all too often we don't recognize, let me see if I can remember this quote. I haven't thought of it for years. Carlos Castaneda. The average person stays closed to opportunities. The warrior stays open to opportunities. So when an opportunity appears, they seize that cubic centimeter of chance. And I just love those words because life from time to time sends us a cubic centimeter of chance. But all too often we say no. I mean, how often do you hear people say, I hear it all the time, well, this is a problem. They say can't versus can. They look at the reasons why they can't get something done, why they won't take the trip, why they won't open the heart, why they won't read the book, why they won't learn the new language. So that chapter is say yes to life.
And open up. Okay, yeah, interesting. And of course, when you read it, I realize it, but I don't want people get confused and says, Robin is the opposite of focusing or whatever. This is absolutely clear. So let's move on to another form of wealth, which is health and wellness. This is something that talked about a lot, especially when we talk about new work concepts and the workplace, because many people struggle these days for obvious reasons. And one of the key factors of mental health is a gentle inner voice. Many of us experience, me for bigger parts of my life, that this voice can be very rude. So my first question to you is, why is the inner voice of many people so rude, even more rude than we would speak to other people? And how can we make it a bit more kinder and a bit more gentle?
We weren't born with rude inner voices. We learned rude inner voices. One of the chapters is apply the Penham principle. Penham is an acronym that deconstructs the five forces that created that inner voice, the five forces that made you, you. P, parents. Our parents teach us how the world works. That gives us our programming. E, our environment. Our environment shapes us. We become the people around us. N, our nation. If you live in a war-torn nation, you're going to have an even stronger inner critic, perhaps, because of the trauma. A, the people around you, associations, and M, the media. Each day we're receiving so many different messages, social media, advertisements. So parents, our environment, our ecosystem, our nation, our associations in terms of our friends and the relationships and the media, these five factors really shape that inner voice. So I think that's one reason, because a lot of that is negative. A lot of that information is toxic. We get this negative inner voice. I think the second thing is all of us experience micro trauma or macro trauma after we leave the innocence of childhood. It could be micro trauma, like we don't get invited to our best friend's birthday party. It could be macro trauma, emergency, illness, accident, loss. But as we go through life, you know, it's human to experience adversity. And a lot of that adversity causes us to dislike ourselves. And then I think the final thing, right, we could talk about more, but the final thing is what we talked about earlier. Potential unexpressed turns to self-loathing. Mm-hmm. So we have enormous promise as human beings. But the more we betray that potential by being victims, by playing small, by wasting our time, by hurting other people, we start to develop this inner field of pain. And the field of pain talks to us in very mean ways. And then very quickly, you said, well, how can we change it? Mm-hmm. There's a number of ways. MVP, as you know, as an athlete, MVP is usually most valuable player. In my methodology, MVP is meditation, visualization, and prayer. Even 20 minutes every morning while the rest of the world is asleep, meditating, visualizing, and praying. And I'm going to be very careful, but it's very likely if you do it for 30 or 40 days, you're going to be significantly transformed. So that's one way to rewire the inner critic into our inner champion. Second way is remove the energy vampires and dream stealers from our life. Mm-hmm. So we can get into the work of Nicholas Christakis, who was realized at Harvard University. We become not only our friends, but we behave like our friends' friends and the friends of their friends. So removing toxic people from our life will upgrade the way we talk to ourselves. And then morning routine, we can talk about that.
Yeah, and this is what made you most famous, I would think. There's another aspect that's quite related to what we're talking about, and it's a concept that many people heard of in terms of the wording, but I think hardly any understand the huge impact on our mental health, and this is the negativity bias. It's a feature that we've built in our brain. It has an evolutionary value. It saved our human species, but today it does more harm to many people than it helps. For those of the listeners who are not deep into this concept, can you explain it in a few sentences what the negativity bias is and how we can tame this built-in feature to get more positivity into our lives?
Absolutely. You're right. The negativity bias is a natural feature of the human brain that served us incredibly well hundreds of years ago when we lived on the savannah. Because if we were not hyper-vigilant against threats, we would be captured by warring tribes, we would be eaten by predators, or we'd stray from the herd and we'd die of starvation. Now, here we are in Berlin, in the modern world, and what happens? We are still hyper-vigilant. We are still scanning our environment for threats, and that looks like we focus on what's not working versus the blessings in our life. What's the antidote? Here's a tactic. I call this the five-question morning maximizer. In your journal every morning, and this will take you maybe 10 minutes, ask yourself five questions and answer them in one paragraph. Number one, what am I grateful for? We know from the work of Sonia Lyubomirsky, for example, that the happiest people in the world practice what she calls deliberate gratitude. So write down a list of the things you're grateful for. That'll start training your brain on your blessings versus your curses. Second question to answer every morning: where am I winning? By focusing on your micro wins, you will protect your hope. You will build energy and momentum. Third question: what will I let go of today? It's one chapter in The Wealth Money Camp by Do Not Be a Resentment Collector. Mm-hmm. How many of us are carrying the people we haven't forgiven with us on our backs through life? What's the cost to our creativity, our productivity, our prosperity, our happiness because of that? So one paragraph, what will I let go of today? Oh, that person who hurt me, that person who betrayed me, that instance where I made a mistake, but you know, I'm human, I'm going to let that go. Fourth question, what does my ideal day ahead look like? So clarity breeds mastery. And what we write about deepens our commitment. One paragraph, here's how I'll live out this day. It'll give you so much more intentionality versus being reactive and just coasting through your day. And then the fifth mm-hmm. question of the five-question morning maximizer is what needs to be said at the end?
At the end of life.
Yes. Memento mori. Remember, you will die. Mm-hmm. Human beings as a species, we live as if we have all the time in the world. So in the morning, you answer the question, okay, on my last day, here's what I want said about me, and here is how I will have wished I will have lived. That way, you're connecting to your mortality, and you're living your day strategically.
One quick question. I wanted to ask it in the end, but now it fits perfectly. Many people would not want to think about death because it pulls them down, it frustrates them. So what can you tell people? You explained the value of this concept, but how can we get a more positive, a more valuable perspective on our ending life?
I just think death is nothing more than a hotel room upgrade.
Explain this.
Well, I think death has a bad reputation.
Yeah, for sure.
In my mind, we're in a 4-star hotel or 5-star hotel as we go through life or whatever it is. And when we die, we go to an even better place with better coffee, more music, and even friendlier people. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really powerful. And the Stoic philosophers like Marcus Aurelius have talked a lot about connecting with your mortality. I don't see it as depressing. I see it as inspiring. I have a mental model that I call my 25 summers philosophy, Chris. I'm healthy, I biohack, I do all those things. Yet if I'm lucky, I have 25 summers left on planet Earth. That philosophy allows me not to hold back on love. That philosophy causes me to move pretty quickly. That philosophy causes me to seize a chance to be of service because I don't know how many days I have left. So connecting to your mortality is not depressing. I think it is absolutely beautiful because all too often we don't give the love we really want to give because we're afraid of rejection. But if you're going to die tomorrow, you wouldn't hold back.
Yes. It reminds me of a present that I made my wife last year for her birthday. It's a poster, A3, A2, I don't know. And there's little bubbles, which is 1 week of your life. And it's pre-filled for 31. This is the birthday that she was at that time. And then given the average life expectancy, there's a few unfilled balls. And seeing the relationship, 31 years gone, maybe 50 left or so. And the idea here is that every Sunday evening, you fill an additional ball because 1 week of your life has gone. And it refocuses you that life is precious. It's exactly what you said with your 25 summers. And I think it's a very strong habit because most people would say, well, I don't like Mondays or whatever. I mean, you say 1/7 of my life is bad. And as you said, if it's infinite, you could have this kind of thinking. But if you realize that you only have so much time left, then the game changes.
No question. Imagine if you, so that's the power of this ritual, the fifth question.
Yeah.
It connects you to, you don't, accident, loss, illness, emergencies, pandemic, wars, it's a part of life right now. And so if you can connect to that, you're going to live in a fundamentally different way. Imagine if you, even every person you met, you thought, I might never see this person again. How would you relate to that person? And the larger point, I think, is every human being on the planet has an ambient fear. And I think it's a fear of death. Mm-hmm. And so imagine, we're all at a subconscious level, we're afraid of death. Imagine the cost of that, the lack of creativity. Imagine how small we're playing because of that. I think it's important to, I don't talk about this very often, but through prayer, meditation, visualization, reading, maybe even working with a therapist, whatever the modality is, befriend the idea that life is short. And I think that would be a powerful way to be so much more courageous and real and brave in the world.
Yes, absolutely. There's another habit that really helped me a lot for one reason, because A, it answered one of my key questions, and I see this with many of my clients that I work with as a coach. You call this savoring. And to give people a bit of context, you frame this as a habit that you see in many ultra-successful people, that they, once they achieved a goal or a mountain top or whatever, they take time and reflect on it. And what I experienced quite long in my life, I get better at it, but I get it and I can relate to that, is that you achieve a goal and you hurry to go to the next one and the next one. So this victory, this macro victory, doesn't sink into your subconscious mind and doesn't pay into your self-worth and your self-respect. So explain people, Robin, please, this protocol of savoring and why it's so important for the wealth that you're talking about here.
Sure. Let's go to the science again. Positive psychologists talk about a term, hedonic adaptation. And that is simply the phenomenon where we get to a place we've always dreamed of getting. Maybe it's a new car. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a beautiful house. Maybe it's a certain level in a relationship. And once we get there, it becomes our new normal. Yeah. And so let's say it's a house. We get that house and we want the bigger house. And it becomes like a drug and we become like hamsters on a wheel. And so savoring is simply consciously making the time. Let's say you have a work win. You go out and have a reward, and maybe it's a dinner. Or maybe it's you do something special for yourself. Maybe you create a ritual, a celebration, and you actually integrate the winning so that it sends a message to your subconscious on the beauty of what you've achieved. Also, as you go through life, one of the chapters in the books is to become a perfect moment creator. And that comes from Eugene O'Kelly. He was the CEO of KPMG, the worldwide accounting behemoth, as you know. He went into his doctor's office and his doctor came back with an expression you never want to see on the face of your doctor. And he was given 90 days left to live. He was told he has an inoperable brain cancer. So he decided to reverse engineer the last 90 days of his life to become what he called a perfect moment creator, because he realized, confronted with his mortality in all his years as a corporate titan, he'd never taken his wife to lunch even once. He'd missed his daughter's Christmas concerts. He hadn't taken long walks with his friends in Central Park. And I think this is such a wise example. So he looked for simple moments to create perfection with the people he loved and for himself. And so savoring could be, you get up in the morning and you say, how can I create a perfect moment with that cup of coffee and a book? And you're fully present and you taste the coffee and you express gratitude for the ability to drink it and you read the book or you listen to the music, but rather than checking your phone, you're there. Because life is very hard right now. There's polycrisis. There's a cost of living crisis. There's so much going on. But life is very beautiful right now. And there are so many simple blessings that are right in front of us that are so easy to miss if we're not there.
Absolutely. The story you just shared reminds me of a guest we had here a few months ago. He's a very famous politician here in Germany. His name is Wolfgang Bosbach, and he is also diagnosed with cancer. And I asked him what he's, if he looks back on his life, what he would do differently. And he said, I spend more time with my with the daughters of my daughters than with my daughters themselves for the whole life. Because as a politician, he had 7 days working until deep into the night and the stuff. And regret at the end of your life is a very powerful thing. And I have one question or two at the end of this conversation regarding this one. There's another beautiful quote that I want to share here with the listeners, and it's this one. You say, please don't spend the best days of your life climbing a mountain, only to realize when it's too late that you've climbed the wrong one. And if we let this statement sink in, I think many people are not really sure if they're climbing the right mountain right now, which is a frustrating state of being. And my question for you, Robin, is what kind of criteria would you give people to evaluate whether it's the right mountain or maybe not the right one?
It's the eight forms of wealth that form the foundation of the book. These are the eight areas to live a rich life: growth, wellness, family, craft, money, because money is important, community, adventure, service. I would actually encourage people to take those eight forms of wealth and do your own evaluation from 1 to 10. And that'll give you a clear map of the areas that you have to work on. But I think it's very true that, you know, Leo Tolstoy wrote a short story called The Death of Ivan Illich. Mm-hmm. And Ivan Illich got to the end of his life and asked himself a fundamentally heartbreaking question. What if my whole life was wrong? And we are tribal. So we listen to the programming of the culture. Sociologists use the term enculturation. Mm-hmm. And this is what we've been taught, that you are successful if you make a lot of money. You mm-hmm. are rich if you have material trophies. But the Zen proverb says it so well, wherever you go, there you are. If we think that a bigger house, a faster boat, more money in the bank is going to make a difference in terms of the way we feel, I think often we're kidding ourselves. And so it's very sad that so many of us are hustling, grinding, trying to get likes on social media, getting these badges of honor that our culture says are forms of wealth and rich and winning, and yet we wake up and we're still empty. And I think the world is going through a very interesting time right now, and that's why there's these seven other forms of wealth.
Mm-hmm. And the most interesting thing about this book is, for me, the following, that there are two interpretations how you could say this is right. Number one is, you experienced great wealth in terms of money, and you've seen it's not the answer, like Jim Carrey said. And other people who will never achieve these kinds of financial goals, they need to accept that they have to go to other forms of wealth. And this could be an excuse for those people. But the interesting part, and you know so many billionaires and those people who more than achieve their goals, they would confirm that it's not the answer. And this is, I think, the key thing, that people can start accepting those alternative forms of wealth, not because they haven't achieved the money goal, but because it's the truth that humans who are wise in this respect, like you, like your clients, have realized in their life. So it prevents you from climbing the wrong hill of not seeing your family, not following your hobbies or whatever, just to earn 500,000 per year. And then you get sick at 50, 55 and see that you have been on this mountain, but it was the wrong one.
Yes, I think the programming goes very deep. And I think even with social media, and all the images of what success is, it can really confuse us. And I want to be very clear again, the fifth form of wealth is money. No one is saying that money and material possessions are wrong. Not at all. It's one of the forms of wealth. Having said that, a great home life and a rich family life are worth more than all the gold in the world.
Yeah.
Having integrity, you can't put a price tag on that. Service, the eighth form of wealth. We chase happiness as human beings. I think if you chase happiness, happiness will always run for you, from you. If you chase helpfulness, happiness will just show up.
Yeah.
The more years I get under my belt, the more I realize great, lasting, sustainable joy comes from leaving people better than you found them. In your work, working with a sense of mission. I think in your work, you have a lot of creative people and entrepreneurs who follow you. When you work with love and devotion and you try to push magic into the marketplace in this world of so much mediocrity, people feel the love that you've put into the app or the screenplay or the restaurant.
Yeah.
If you treat people, even strangers, I'm here at a hotel in Berlin. I have a habit. I'm not saying I'm some kind of guru, I'm something special, but I do my best to remember that when I leave the hotel room, someone will come in to clean it. That's someone's brother or mother or father or sister. So I make the bed. I know it might sound strange, but I make the bed. I leave a great tip. I put the towels in the bathtub. It's just, there are so many little things we can do to make the lives of other people better. And it's so easy to get so busy, we forget about those simple gestures of humanity, of service. And that brings us so much happiness.
Absolutely. And I'm sure I'm not the only one here who could listen to you for hours and hours. There's two more concepts that I want to ask you for your perspective for. Number one is you suggest that people every now and then should go for a dopamine detox. And for many people, this sounds almost impossible because they are so addicted to their phone and to this visual and audio input. And please explain to us, Robin, why people should stop doing something for a specific period of time, even though they enjoy it, because people enjoy getting dopamine. And how would a protocol look like that you would suggest for people?
Well, so we know that dopamine is the neuroregulator of inspiration, makes us feel good. And often when we're with our phones, for example, or doing things that we enjoy, as you say, there's dopamine. But the thing about that is, unless we take a pause, then the baseline continues to get higher and higher. So we become like drug addicts, and we need to do it more to get the same fix and good feelings. So one of the chapters in the book is go ghost for a year. And the idea there is you leave your phone at home, metaphorically speaking, and you go to the place you've always wanted to go to. Some people can do this, maybe if you don't have a family, but you take the classics and you go to Vietnam or Bali or Sweden or Medellin. You read the classics, you isolate yourself, you learn to meditate, you get super fit, you build yourself up, and then you return to the world born anew. If you can't do it for a year, do it for a month. Can't do it for a month, do it for a week. Can't do it for a week, do it for a day. But it's important to get away from your phone, to get away from all of your escapes, to get away from all of your fixes, to get to know yourself again. Your relationship with money, your relationship with your work, your relationship with your family, your relationship with your fellow citizens, all reflects your relationship with yourself.
Yeah.
Please don't be so busy being busy that we don't get to know who we are, our values, what we want to stand for, what we want to do. And the more clarity you can build and the more intimacy you can grow with your gifts and your talents, the more every other relationship in the world will be influenced by that.
Absolutely. And in my philosophy, in my coaching program, we call this the intermittent phone fasting. So like many people know, it has benefit not putting fuel and nutrition into your body 24 hours per day. And so the same applies to our phone. So leaving your phone 8, 10, 12, maybe 16 hours. So on my major days, I lock my phone at 6 p.m. in the evening in the basement.
Great.
When I go out with my dog, and I leave it there until 12 p.m. the next day. So I have 16 to 18 hours where my phone is out of sight. I create huge barriers because I'm very addicted. I'm very honest with this. But if it's far away, out of sight, and then I can handle it. And these are my best and most joyful hours when I don't feel the urge to check what my LinkedIn post is doing or my TikTok videos or whatever.
I think I call it a zero device day. I think at least every 7 days, 20, I love 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And that's what I encourage, 24 hours without your phone. And as you say, some very strong digital hygiene and some very strong red lines. You definitely want to lock it away, put it in the trunk of your car. A second tool I would offer is the two phone protocol. So you have one phone with all your apps and all your social media, very attractive. You have a second phone. Maybe it's like a 10-year-old phone.
Nokia.
Exactly. And you have that phone with you when you're on your walk. So your family, in the case of an emergency, can get you. But there's no social.
Yeah.
There's no weather.
Yeah.
There's no news. And that's the phone you have, not only when you're walking, but when you're working. There's a concept I have called the 5 great hour rule. I think all you need are 5 great hours a day on work.
You get more done than most people in a week.
And that's, keep the Spartan simple phone with you then, so you're doing real work versus fake work.
Yeah, that's great. And the final concept, Robin, is, and we touched it already in the beginning when you gave examples of monumental work, is the Project X. This is your branding for your key project where you put all your genius, all your focus, all your passion, all your dedication into it. And what I experience, and I don't exclude myself here, is that we all have this idea that portfolio is better than a single investment. From investment strategies, this makes sense to reduce risk and stuff. But in terms of work, it's dangerous. If we spread our passion and our power across too many projects. Now, my question is twofold. Number one, how can we identify what our true Project X is? And number two, how can we develop the bravery to go all in instead of trying to do 5 things because it's easier and less risky.
Well, I love your portfolio example. That's very intelligent. And I would say the goal with work is not to spread risk. The goal with work is to push your magic into the world in need of magic.
Yes.
Let's not be on defense. No athlete wins playing defense. Kobe became Kobe because he was always on offense. The moment we start spreading risk and saying, I need to create a portfolio and 50 pieces of content or 1,000 because one will hit. And I hear that. I think we're diluting our genius. Mm-hmm. I think the key is, the term I use in The Wealth Money Can't Buy, do your Project X. A Project X is the one project. It could take you 30 years. It could take you a lifetime. But it's your Sistine Chapel ceiling. It's your Taj Mahal. It's your Mona Lisa. It represents the best within you and what you want to put out in the world. The goal is not to put out a lot of content. The goal is to put out masterwork versus mediocrity. And then you say, well, how do we know what our Project X is? And I would say your instinct is so much wiser than your intellect. Intellect for an entrepreneur or creative is, here's the market opportunity. Here's what's selling. Here's what is on the bestseller list. your instinct is, no, this is what I want to do. This is what feels right to me. And this is the project that lights me up. And when you do what lights you up, and you do it with honesty, devotion, service, sacrifice, when you do what lights you up, you light up the world. And then you asked about bravery. How do you become more brave? Bravery is not a gift that is bestowed. Bravery is a skill that is earned. We become brave by doing brave things. And start with what I call micro bravery. It's just little micro acts of fearlessness. And as you do that, you will start to rewire your self-identity. Let me put it to you this way. Courage is like a muscle. And this morning I got into the gym and
I've seen it on Instagram. So very empty at the time that you train.
It was a very empty gym, and I flexed what little muscles I have. But the more you flex your muscles in the gym, the stronger they'll grow. And the more you exercise your courage, the more brave you'll become. And if you do it every day, just like tennis, you're going to be a master of courage over time.
Yeah. What's in one sentence? What would you call your personal Project X?
To help as many people as possible realize their personal genius and live beautiful lives.
And this is way on a very good track on. I have two final questions, Robin. The first one is, you know your book way better than we all do. Is there any question that I didn't ask you but that you really like to answer in this conversation?
Well, I would say one chapter is coming to mind, and it's Find Your Personal Goldeneye. Mm-hmm. James Bond creator Ian Fleming realized that you can be in the world and hear the noise, or you can be alone and hear the signal. Mm-hmm. So he bought a cottage called Goldeneye in Jamaica where he would go to write his masterpieces. And I think what I'm encouraging in that chapter is let us all find our own Goldeneye. And it doesn't have to be this cottage in Jamaica. It could be a spare room in our apartment. But one thing about all geniuses, they were alone a lot. And mastery loves isolation. So I would just say it's important for us to find our own Goldeneye.
Mm-hmm. Great. And as I said, I could go on for hours, so I hope it's not our last conversation here. But my final question, and this is a default in all episodes, is the following. If you look back on your personal ups and downs in life, what is your most important lesson?
Well, there's a few. First of all, is the leader who learns the most wins. I mean, just education is inoculation against disruption. Listen to the podcasts, read the books, get a mentor, learn. Second thing, KMF, keep moving forward. Mm-hmm. Japanese say, get knocked down 7 times, get up 8. Third thing I would say, happiness comes from service. When I was growing up, my dad used to say, Robin, when you were born, you cried while the world rejoiced. Live your life in such a way that when you die, the world cries while you rejoice. It's such a great way to live, and it's a key to joy. And I want to just honor my father, because on Friday, he's going to be 86 years old. And he taught me so much, so I want to celebrate him.
Yes. So let's celebrate your dad. Let's celebrate you and your book. Robin, thank you so much. The Wealth Money Can Buy. In German, we say Reichtum, den du mit Geld nicht kaufen kannst. That's correct. And I really recommend that everyone gets this book in their hands. Thank you for serving humanity the way you do. And I wish you a great time in Berlin here, and hope to see you again very soon.
It's been a great joy. And thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.